Professor.
I think the real problem that we have is the lack of outrage. If there's, imagine if some group or some multinational corporation popped into Auburn and started poisoning the streams or the lakes.
That has happened.
No, deliberately, with arsenic, let's suppose. Okay. Nothing subtle, but something explicit. Fair enough, they have. But if that was, you know, if that was sort of like intentional and not as a byproduct, there would be outrage. Or if the multinational corporations walked in, stepped in here and started just shooting people at random, every third person that walked by a particular stop, maybe that's already happening too, and so I'll be corrected on this. There would be outrage. So the question that really occurs to me is, why isn't there outrage? You know, why isn't there outrage about the fact that all the things that we have been talking about and all the things that you have been asking about and mentioning are happening in this world and happening for now hundreds of years even. So why isn't there that outrage? And I can think of two things that explain why there isn't that outrage. And one is fear. Fear of speaking up. I have it. But there's another thing, and that is acceptance. Acceptance of the terms. Sort of a complicity with the dominant ideology. And some of the things that I think that we accept and are complicit in is the idea of a meritocracy, that in some ways people, as you mentioned just a second ago, people get what they deserve. And the idea of the same idea of desert, that, you know, there's a way in which there's some kind of ultimate calculus that's going on in the cosmos in which people do get what they deserve. Or a complicity in the idea that when you compete, that's a legitimate basis for establishing a hierarchy, a ranked hierarchy. You know, everybody competes, we'll figure out where everybody falls, and that's legitimate. So I think, you know, while we're building institutions and making arguments and trying to work out coalitions and organize, et cetera, we could also work on ourselves and think about how it is that we are complicit and accept some of the things that, if we actually work them through, amount to the poisoning of our waters and the shooting of our neighbors.
That was Naeem and Atula. The next voice you'll hear is that of moderator and former Auburn mayor, Guy Cosentino.
And I guess I will interrupt here as someone who's been involved in pilots. There are some good pilots and there are some bad pilots. And it is something that a community does need to look at. And I think it is a valid issue if you're dealing with a box store and where you are going to have some job creation, how much of a pilot do you give? What type of deal do you give? For example, if you are going to lose in a sour economy and despite what may be said, in 1991, upstate New York had a really lousy economy in the late 80s and early 90s, and one of the questions was, is there going to be this continued hemorrhaging of jobs to the south? Because at that point, we were talking about the Rust Belt in the Northeast to the Sun Belt in the south and the west, mm-hmm. And do you continue with that? And that is why, and I will tell you point blank, one of the decisions that was made was not only the pilot, but there were other deals given in that. And let's be honest, there was a water and a sewer deal, because at that point, water and sewer, by the way, were really cheap in the city of Auburn at that point. We did the upgrades at a later day, but there were those items. Now, as to the 750, that may have been the successor agreement.
It was 700.
Yeah, 700, that may have been the 2001 deal. But that may be a different issue. And there are companies that are tied on there. One of those first companies was originally McQuay, or when it was known as Snyder General. Another one has been the fiber optics company it's a different one. Not Fostech, but down the street from there. And there have been ties to those. But one of the things that the state has done is said you can't, for example, do pilots for grocery stores now, because not necessarily are people going to eat more food. I may, and that's a bad example, but you pick and choose what type of job creation you do from there. And so I just wanted to clarify that only because I was kind of involved in that one. So we'll go to number five.
Could I say one thing about the first person? Just because this is a great story, amongst other things, about the change in states' abilities to regulate corporations. You have the senator from New York to thank for that. not either of the current senators, but Roscoe Conkling. Roscoe Conkling was the senator from New York, and he chaired the subcommittee that wrote the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which basically took the provisions of the 5th Amendment and applied it to the state, that said a state could deprive no citizen of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and that all citizens should have equal protection under the law. And then kind of the Democratic Party engineered him out, and he didn't run for Senate, and he quit, and he got a job as a railroad lawyer. And so in 1887, he went before the Supreme Court of the United States representing a railroad, the Santa Clara Railroad, and made the following argument. I wrote the 14th Amendment. Here are my notes to the And you know, the entire time, I always meant that our corporate citizens are citizens too. And when a state regulates a corporation, that they're doing so without due process of law, and if they single out a corporation, they are not giving equal protection under the law. And so basically corporations are people too. And the Supreme Court bought the argument. And so ever since that whole series of cases involving railroads in the West, that individual states do not have the legal right to regulate a corporation doing interstate commerce because it's seen as a violation of the 14th Amendment, which initially had been intended for one of the amendments that the Confederate states had to sign to get back into the Union after the Civil War, which, by the way, wasn't about slavery.
By the way, there is a new book out, picking on books, is The History of the Corporation. I think it's by Oxford Press. It's a very short book. It's 180 pages. It's getting rave reviews both from the left and the right. It's just covering everything from Business Week gave it high marks to the New York Times. And I even believe The Nation did a very fairly positive review, though it said it was too short and didn't go into enough detail of the horrors. But that's a different story. Sir?
I'm Ken Malkin. I'd like to ask particularly the labor leader. My understanding on the question of the minimum wage and living wage, I understand from an email from the Working Families Party last year that just before the state legislature adjourned, that Senate and Assembly conferees had agreed on, and also maybe even representatives and governor, had agreed on a minimum wage law increase and maybe even a COLA in that, and that the email said that McDonald's and others got in touch with the governor just before the election and succeeded in getting him to withdraw the support, at least to the Senate conferees, from that agreement. And so I want to ask, basically, is that right history? And secondly, what do you think the chances are that a minimum wage law might pass this legislative session now that there's not just before an election? I want to comment real quickly that if you heard President Bush this morning, the way he talked about what we're going to do in Iraq, we're going to rebuild the economy, great medical care for everyone, education for everyone, social services for everyone, I guess if you want to get any of that social services and stuff, I guess you'd have to move to Iraq. Or maybe it's one of those things he's going to try it, and if it does work, maybe he'll come back here and try rebuilding this economy. Adelphia, my Adelphia cable thing went up just after the owner of also the Buffalo Sabres was led to jail for stealing millions, so I think that does raise the cost of your product when you're that way. And I just hope that somehow, as we are going to see the small s socialism being hacked away at pretty vociferously at every one of our county and school budgets and services and increase in property taxes this year, I hope we'll get some outrage generated. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead. And we'll come back to some of these points in just a moment.
All right. I have to admit to you that when it comes to economics and the workings of money, I feel like a complete fool. I every time I try to understand money, I get completely jammed up at how money economies could get started in the first place. I mean, people trade a pig for a couple of sheep or something like that, and everybody walks away happy. But I don't see how we could go from that barter economy to money economy. And now, so that lets you know my level of ignorance before I start talking. The thing that occurs to me is almost all of what we've been talking about are very, very large-scale systems of wealth-generating institutions, large corporations, and things like that. You don't hear too much these days, at least it seems to me, that you don't hear about individual entrepreneurial kind of work or small-scale startups. Maybe that's just because I don't move in those circles. Is there anything promising on the horizon for entrepreneurs and that method of creating jobs as opposed to sort of government policy creating jobs?
We'll ask if there's number 7 or 8. And you get your last chance because we're going to wrap up with a couple of, because we have a couple of follow-ups on there. We'd also like to, we'll start off with you on the minimum wage issue. But one question that did not get answered was the Labor Party issue. And I think that was a number of you nodded your heads, and we should talk about that as well.
Okay. Can I say something on the
Labor Party? Sure, go ahead.
That I think any alternative to the kind of stranglehold of the Demopublicans and Republicrats will probably increase the level of democracy. If you look at through most of the world, there are lots of multiple parties. And I want to, seeing as September 11th is in the news, I want to hearken back a little bit to September 11th, not 2001, but September 11th, 1973, when a coup happened in a country called Chile. In 1970, there was an election there. And if you went down to Chile, I had friends that went down to Chile, said it was the most vibrant place you could. You could stop any 14-year-old kid on the street and probably get a more sophisticated political analysis that you could get from an American college professor. 99% of the people voted. And amazingly, they elected someone who never expected to win, a man named Salvador Allende. Henry Kissinger turned around and said, we can't sit back and let a country go communist just because of the irresponsibility of its own people to elect one. The first thing that the Allende government did was to say, no Chilean child, no matter how poor, shall be without milk. The second thing they did was nationalize the world's largest copper mine that was owned by a telephone company, International Telephone and Telegraph, which, by the way, got a little bit famous around there because they told the Justice Department if they would drop the antitrust lawsuit that they'd pay for the Republican convention. And the memo got lost. A woman named Dita Beard wrote it. And they found out where it was. It was in the desk of Larry O'Brien, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And so they sent some burglars in to steal it, and they got caught. O'Brien's desk, of course, was in the Watergate Hotel, and all of this stuff unraveled. Well, then there was a coup that the CIA funded and IT&T paid for, and even though Augusto Pinochet was indicted for war crimes by the Spanish, that Chile is now democratic, but It's a safe democracy. It's a democracy like we have here. 35% to 40% of the people vote, and no matter what the outcome of the election, that the fundamental relations of power never, ever, ever change hands. That in the election in Chile, the power relationships had changed. But I thought even had Al Gore won, the fundamental power relationships never would have changed hands. I think that we're going to have labor parties and radical parties and socialist parties. We're going to have a lot of parties if the fundamental power relationships are ever going to change hands. So I think it would be a good. I think it would be a good thing.
I agree. However, I think there's a real question of leadership in all the parties and a lack thereof. And I think that's true of labor, too. I don't know. I think the more voices, the better. Would a labor party help the American press? Probably. What realistically can we expect in terms of political leadership to develop a labor party? I don't know. We barely get leadership, you know, in the parties that we have. So I don't know. The way the labor party's developed in, let's say, England, Scotland, Ireland, just a little bit Israel, is different really than our history here. I don't know. It's an interesting question. And one of my really ambivalent pieces of my work is my political work, in that to work with, I never understood why politicians had such a, lousy name, and why that was kind of a nasty phrase, until I really started working with them. And there are people who are visionary leaders who never waver, and they really have a vision, and they're few and far between and very rare and difficult to find. Paul Wellstone was one of them, I think. Jimmy Carter. But then there's just a lot of politicians who just wait to see which way the wind's going to blow. And, I have to work with a lot of them, and I really am very ambivalent about it because I don't like it, but I know that's how it works. I don't know. And would a labor party become that? Would the leaders have to become that? And it's kind of this rush to the middle? I don't know. I think it would be something worth exploring, but I have a real fear that it would kind of turn out to be like politics as normal. I don't know. It's a really interesting area to try to work with. The minimum wage versus the living wage. You have to be careful. As far as the minimum wage raise at the end of the last legislative session, I don't know very much about that, but I suspect the story is absolutely correct. I think we have to be careful in distinguishing between a minimum wage versus living wage. The minimum wage is not a living wage. You cannot live on it by any stretch of the imagination. So I think what we have to start looking at politically is something called a living wage, which looks at individual areas, counties, states, to say what would a person need to meet the barest minimum so they don't have to be on social services in that area. And there's some studies done, and they're so living wages are based on something called a self-sufficiency standard, which estimates what it would cost to be self-sufficient for all different family types. And it uses factors in costs for food, housing, childcare, and health care. And since those are really different in different parts of the country or in different parts of a state even, all that's kind of taken into account. So the living wage is really tailored to a certain area. And I think that's actually a really intelligent way of looking at it. But living wage, I think, is a more reasonable way to look at things versus a minimum wage. So I've kind of a little bit given up on the minimum wage as a political process, although, it's the only floor we have at the moment, so we've got to work with it. But I would like to see us move more towards a more intelligent floor being a living wage.
And there are efforts locally.
Mm-hmm. There's a living wage coalition here in Auburn, and we really have been working very hard with a lot of different groups within the city. So, yeah, anyone's welcome to come.
Thank you. Professor, we started with you. We shall end with you. To wrap up, any closing thoughts?
Well, I think it looks dismal. And when it looks dismal, the first step is to say it looks dismal. I don't think that the solutions that we're trying to struggle with here are real solutions. We all feel it. Let's admit it. It's a really dismal situation that we're living in at the present moment. And that one of the things that has to come on top of that is that we have to give up the idea that that we can be bought on the basis of being the world's only superpower, that we can be bought on the basis of being told that this is a democracy. It feels like fascism to me. It's kind of a comfortable fascism for many of us, given the statistics that we're being told by my
co-panelist here. But nevertheless, it very much feels like fascism to me. You know, perhaps the first step that we can say to ourselves is, this is a dismal situation. And the reason that it's a dismal situation is because the elites have really perfected modern fascism in two ways. One is they have complete control of the ideological mechanisms, and if any community in any place in this country attempts to do the kinds of things that we have been talking about, they always have force.
And you've been listening to a panel on wealth, class, and America's role in the world, held in Auburn, New York, on April 28th.
Oh, where are you going, says Miller to Munger. We may not tell you, says Johnson to Judd. We're going to mill, says Jack to our jail. We're going to the factory, says little Ned Ludd. And what will you do there, says Miller to Munger. Do you swear to tell no one, says Johnson to Judd. We'll break the machinery, improve the scenery, meet in the greenery after, says Ludd.
Now we'll turn to Argentina. Only a few years ago, Argentina was hailed as a poster child of globalized free market capitalism. James Petras is a professor emeritus at SUNY Binghamton and is the co-author of Globalization Unmasked, Imperialism in the 21st Century. He published an article late last year in the Covert Action Quarterly, Argentina Between Disintegration and Revolution. Petras gave a brief history and explanation of the economics and politics of the Argentine crisis.
In 1989, there was hyperinflation that led to the downfall of a conservative government. The elected president was Menem and came in as a populist, one who promised to raise living standards. Soon after the election, he appointed a cabinet representing the extreme right and appointed a favorite of Wall Street named Domingo Cavallo as his economic czar. They proceeded to implement a program, probably, as the World Bank said, the most faithful student in all of Latin America, if not the world, in applying all the formulas. They created a peso which was on parity with the dollar and was tied to the issuance of currencies that could only be backed by the dollar. They privatized over 1,000 enterprises, including banks, land, and all kinds of industries, telecommunications. They lowered their trade barriers, let the imports subsidized in Europe and in the United States enter without any controls. They deregulated the financial system so capital could come in and out. And so as a result of that, beginning in 1993 till about 97, Argentina grew as lots of money came in to buy out the jewels of the economy. Cheap imports came in, and all of this was financed by tremendous amounts of borrowing as the banks received high interest payments. They were buying out assets. So there was a boom of 5 or 6% growth. The Economic Commission for Latin America, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, World Bank, all hailed Argentina as a model based on this short period of artificial growth based on external financing and selling off resources. From 94, 95, 96, 97, up through 98, the yearly reports of the World Bank were eulogizing Menem, saying, well, he's a bit corrupt, probably the most corrupt president in the history of Argentina. But for them, this was a secondary problem because he had followed their prescriptions and the multinational banks, Citibank and the rest of the gang, took advantage of this great opportunity to buy the resources in Argentina on the cheap. The net effect of all this was to undermine a local industry and to heavily indebt Argentina, and to undermine the capacity of Argentina to pay back these loans, as their productive facilities now were in foreign hands and geared to stimulating exports short-term gains. 1998 was the turning point, the beginning toward stagnation. The debts were piling up, and Cavallo was engaged in some imaginative accounting, familiar to those of us in the United States with Enron, etc. And so 98 was a slowdown in the economy, but a worsening of the overall financial situation. By 99, the country was in full recession, and that was the first of 4 years. Now we're going on the fifth year. By 2001, the economy was really collapsing. At that point, early in 2001, the big money smelled the rats and saw the ship was not viable, the economy was not viable, and they got about $45 billion out of Argentina. Argentine elites also had been depositing their loans and others overseas, and then they loaded this debt onto the government that took over some of this private debts. And by December of 2001, it was clear the ship was collapsing. The government froze over 2 million people's saving account, their lifetime savings, etc., including savings that were indexed in dollars. And so you had approximately 10 million Argentines that were affected by the loss of their total savings. And so you began to get a combination of financial collapse, wiping out the savings of the middle class, unemployment skyrocketing to 20 to 25%. Then you had a devaluation which reduced incomes by two-thirds, so that per capita income in Argentina, which in 98 was the highest in Latin America at over $9,000, by January of 2002, it had dropped to 3,000 and was down around the level of Peru. So here's a country that can feed 330 million people, the breadbasket and the most rich area of farming in the world, with 2 meters of topsoil, if you can believe that. And they have a malnutrition problem for over 40% of the children in the country. Over 56% of the people today are under the poverty line. So this now is the situation. In December 19th and 20th, the Argentine people, I say this as a very rigorous sense, you had hundreds of thousands of middle-class people who spontaneously jammed the Plaza de Mayo in front of the government and only a couple of blocks from the Congress and demanded the ouster of the government. The precipitating factor was the government's decision to declare a state of emergency, which would have prohibited even the sufferers even discussing or meeting to discuss their common problem. So this was rubbing salt into the wound, and the hundreds of thousands of people came out in Buenos Aires, and this radicalized middle class was joined by the unemployed workers' organizations and the picateros, who are been blocking highways to get minimal food and minimal employment. And so you had a kind of worker, middle class, and unemployed demanding and eventually ousting the then president De La Rua, who had replaced Menem, and simply fled in a helicopter. And that situation has prolonged to now. It hasn't gotten better. The IMF and the World Bank, under instructions from their governments in Europe and the United States, are refusing to fund any bailout in Argentina, because at least the Europeans don't think the government will exonerate the banks for facilitating the illegal flight of billions of dollars and stripping assets, robbing the savers of any chance of getting reimbursed. Basically, they want to put Argentina through the ringer, because as a consequence of the popular uprising, one of the four presidents who came and went that declared a moratorium on a part of the debt payment. And Washington was furious because this set an example for the rest of the Third World, which is heavily indebted, and decided to punish them. And also, I think Washington doesn't think any of the political leaders, no matter how cozy they want to get with Washington, are capable of resolving this conflict in a way favorable to the banks. They either have the correct politics as far as what have the lack of support, or they oppose U.S. policy and has support. So I think Washington is looking that all the politicians become, the populace becomes disenchanted with these politicians and gets tired of demonstrating, and then I think they'll back a military regime, a return, which has absolutely no support at this time, but I think they'll do a Musharraf. They'll put in some military with the intelligence, and we'll have a bloody dictator. I think that's where they're going. O'Neill made a speech while I was in Argentina. Paul O'Neill, the U.S. Secretary of Treasury, and he declared the problem with Argentine leaders is they lack the will, which means that they're too wimpy, they're not forceful enough, they're not violent enough to impose even further cuts on a population that's lost two-thirds of their standard of living. So when he uses that terminology in the context of the regime that he's in, we know they're talking about a dictatorial regime. And I think down the road, in a year or two, I think we'll see Washington acting in that fashion. We can imagine the editorial hand-wringing in the New York Times saying, unfortunately, the Argentines are too irresponsible. Unfortunately, the military takes power. We hope that they'll return to democracy as soon as possible, etc., etc. The kind of Pontius Pilate hypocrisy that always turns up in the respectable newspapers and give backdoor support to these anti-democratic moves by Washington. Whenever they make decisions behind closed doors in small groups, they accuse people that identify those policies as conspiracy theorists, etc., as if any major decisions is ever made in public defining what the real goals of the government are. It went actually in two stages. The first stage was the privatization, the large-scale enterprise were initially bought up by very wealthy, powerful economic elites in Argentina. The second phase, these groups in turn sold off to foreign investors and took their money out of the country. When the economy started to go down in Argentina, it was largely for domestic reasons. However, some investors thought this was a new opportunity to buy out even cheaper resources. And so it wasn't until really 1999, after the collapse in Asia. Now, one interesting thing about this is while Korea went through the ringer and by 2000 was beginning a new wave of expansion, in Argentina, you had the opposite effect of a very big slide downward. And that's because in Korea, you still had an industrial base and a incomes policy which allowed for the economic recovery and growth. Whereas in Argentina, they had sold off all the resources and had depended on external financing to sustain consumption. So that, in effect, you have Argentina in an insoluble crisis, a crisis without end, and in Korea you had a kind of traditional boom and bust business cycle, which is now on the On a second row. Argentina was a clear case of pillage, and the president and his whole entourage of the Peronist Party were each taking big bites. IBM was involved in a big bribery case, $170 million contract, of which the kickback was over 10%. There was some squabbling between IBM and the Menem regime about the level of kickbacks. So there was a mixture here of high level and very extensive corruption and enormous movements of capital outside. To give you one idea, and I'm not talking just about foreign capital, Argentine elites have over $160 billion deposited outside of the country, mostly, but not exclusively, in the United States. Moved, washed by the leading banks of the United States. And studies that were done by the U.S. Senate, led by Senator Levin of Michigan, has demonstrated that between $200 and $500 billion flows into the U.S. as black money every year. During the 90s, U.S. Senate report, they have five case studies. One heavily implicating Citibank of New York, or Citibank headquarters in New York, in washing money for the brother of ex-president Salinas of Mexico to the tune of $180 million. Just one case where they set up a dummy account. They even gave the pseudonym to the bag person, and they engaged in the bundling to make sure that the shift in money wasn't identified. And even when he was indicted, they still refused to cooperate. So you have a problem here of pillage, not simply capitalism in the and what the leftists and Marxist economists talk about, the crisis of capitalism and as a product of simply the laws of motion of capital and the generation of surplus value from exploitation. But you have here naked plunder of the economy and the massive transfer of that pillage overseas. It's comparable to what the Brits did in the 16th and 17th century, piracy, which transferred hundreds of millions of dollars to the British Treasury and fueled a good part of their economic growth and industrialization. It's an extremely rich country. They've started in now on buying land. Argentina has one of the most fertile pampas, plains in the world. The foreign ownership, including our progressive speculator, George Soros, is now the biggest landowner in Argentina. So there's still resources to be had. Of course, there's a diminishing of available resources, and some of the foreign investors have simply skimmed the wealth and have left the enterprises in dire condition. I'm talking about Iberia Airlines buying out Aérea Argentina and running it from a profitable state-owned enterprise into a deficit-indebted enterprise. So I think there is still resources to pillage, but I think they're not going in with the same fervor and certainly not at the scale of the past. There's virtually little new investment going into Argentina, and whoever's going in now is going in purely on a short-term basis, if at all. And so you have this problem of demanding Argentina pay back loans while the net inflow from overseas is zero. The next place that's heading down this road is Brazil, and though all the speculation is about the fears of investors, with the election of Lula, the Workers' Party. I think this is a gross misperception. I think the real reason that Brazil is in crisis is that the public debt has tripled in the last 8 years. The economy has been growing under the Cardoso presidency at the lowest rates in the 20th century. That is between 1994 and 2002. You have a rate of growth in Brazil of approximately 2%, which is half the average of any decade in the 20th century. So you have stagnation, debt piling up, a very backward, a large backward agricultural sector, even as you have a very growth-minded export sector. You have a country which has the worst inequalities and constraints on any domestic market in the world, and this is a fact that's been noted by even the most reactionary surveys, agencies like the World Bank and others. And I think that Brazil is on the verge of a collapse, and it has little to do with Lula and the elections. It has to do with the long-term and deep structural features that have been induced by these free market extremists. At a time when the U.S. is imposing more and more trade barriers on items like sugar, cotton, even calamaris and shrimps have quotas on them. While Washington proclaims the free market for Brazil or any other country, it embraces a highly statist policy, a huge subsidies, $180 billion for the next 10 years in agriculture, $4 billion alone in cotton. While it does this, it tells other countries to drop their pants, and Washington will play the role of the free marketeer. There's never any critical reflections and any deep and profound sense. They either say, well, the country didn't go far enough in the free market, or that there was corruption, or they borrowed too much at the wrong time, at the wrong place. All these ad hoc, improvised, and patently inaccurate appraisals of the situation. There's infinite regression here of post hoc explanations that have very little weight and certainly don't take account of the deep structural imbalances that they created with their policies. And I can say that in every case, if you look at it in the big picture, what they call the fundamentals were sound, were actually the building blocks for the collapse. The other thing about the international agencies is they're very corrupt and dishonest. They never complain about the U.S. budget deficit, the fact that Germany and France are breaking the deficit goals of the unification of Europe, that the U.S. engaged in the wildest speculative, unproductive, unsustainable economic policies, and yet they want countries in the third world which need deficit spending, which need to finance productive activity, they want them to have a zero deficit simply because they think that way more money will be available to pay overseas debtors. It has absolutely nothing to do with a development strategy or sound economics. The only forward motion is among the grassroots organization. You have these popular assemblies that have sprung up in the middle class areas, people who've seen their savings wiped out. You have whole cities in the interior of the country have actually been occupied by public employees, teachers, health workers who haven't been paid in 3 or 4 months. And when they're paid in funny money, which can only be used in that particular province. These are people that they're seeing their living standards decline. They have seen no payments on their salaries for 3 or 4 months. They've seen massive cutbacks in public services, and you have a tremendous growth of unemployment. And the most paradoxical thing is you see huge railroad caravans crossing the country full of grain and beef to the overseas markets, while the people in Argentina watching those trains from the improvised towns don't have enough to eat. These are countries that are very advanced. They're not backward rural countries. Argentina had the highest proportion of industrial workers, one of the highest in the world, and certainly the highest in the third world, with over 40% of its labor force in manufacturing and industry. Brazil is the 11th biggest economy in the world today. So we're talking about countries that are very high up as far as development. And I think that's what's most frightening to some of the capitalist economies. 1/4 of the securities on the in the emerging markets, as they're called, were held in Argentina. So the ramifications of this are very significant for all countries. And I think what's become increasingly evident, particularly in both countries, is the tremendous reservoir of support for a radical transformation, or what in the old language we would call a revolution. That doesn't mean people are looking at guerrillas or anything of the sort, but in Argentina, they're certainly at the barricades. These are failed states, products of Washington and Europe and Canada's political engineering that has led to this disintegration. And I think the reconstruction of these countries and their economies will depend on new leadership outside of the established political elites. And when I see former senior executives who've lost their job, as I saw in Tucumán in the interior of Argentina, a person who I knew 25 years ago was a conservative, I would say right-wing executive, today talking the language of anti-imperialism, who lost his job, lost his savings, and at the age of 75 today is scrambling, selling out of his automobile around the state. I see this economic determinism that has so radicalized even the most conservative elite sections. This is, to me, even who I've seen a lot in the last 45 years of my travels in Latin America. This is kind of shocking. It's no longer just the working class. It's downwardly mobile millions of middle-class people in Argentina who are at the front lines of these massive turnouts today. But there are some hopeful signs. Let me not finish on a negative note. I attended meetings in several factories that were on the verge of being closed down. The workers occupied the factories, and have over 200 factories are being managed by workers. And I was in a ceramics factory in Neuquén in Argentina, which is producing excellent ceramics and is running at full production, and has recruited a dozen unemployed workers that supported their takeover and now have full-time jobs in this worker-run factory. It's very inspiring to see how engineers and technical people, administrative people, working with manual workers in operating the factory. And I think this has become a lesson that you don't need capitalists to have a productive and efficient economy.
That was James Petras, Professor Emeritus at SUNY Binghamton and co-author of Globalization Unmasked, Imperialism in the 21st Century. Thanks to Greg Dufell of CKLN's International Connection for that tape.
From Notts up to Lancashire, Yorkshire to Derbyshire, 1811 to 1813, Ladd's army enlisted and the people resisted the march of a more money-making machine.
The successes of the factory takeovers in Argentina have threatened the basis of the capitalist social order. And this apparently concerns the government more than the condition of its impoverished citizens. Canadian journalist and author Naomi Klein was in Argentina and published the following article in the London Guardian on April 28th. It's called Snapshot of a Nation: How Argentina's New President Deals with the Occupied Factories Will Be Hugely Significant. Klein wrote, in 1812, bands of British weavers and knitters raided textile mills and smashed industrial machines with their hammers. According to the Luddites, the new mechanized looms had eliminated thousands of jobs and broken communities and deserved to be destroyed. The British government disagreed and called in a force of 14,000 soldiers to brutally repress the worker revolt and protect the machines. Fast forward 2 centuries to another textile factory, this one in Buenos Aires. At the Brookman factory, which has been producing men's suits for 50 years, it's the riot police who smash the sewing machines and the 58 workers who risk their lives to protect them. Last Monday, the Brookman factory was the site of the worst repression Buenos Aires has seen in almost a year. Police had evicted the workers in the middle of the night and turned the entire block into a military zone guarded by machine guns and attack dogs. Unable to get into the factory and complete an outstanding order for 3,000 pairs of dress trousers, the workers gathered a huge crowd of supporters and announced it was time to go back to work. At 5 p.m., 50 middle-aged seamstresses in no-nonsense haircuts, sensible shoes and blue work smocks walked up to the black police fence. Someone pushed, the fence fell, and the Brookman women, unarmed and arm in arm, slowly walked through. They had only taken a few steps when the police began shooting tear gas, water cannons, rubber bullets, then lead. The police even charged the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in their white headscarves embroidered with the names of their disappeared children. Dozens of demonstrators were injured and police fired tear gas into a hospital where some had taken refuge. This is a snapshot of Argentina in the week of its presidential elections. Each of the 5 major candidates is promising to put this crisis-ravaged country back to work. Yet Brookman's workers are treated as if sewing a gray suit were a capital crime. Why this state Luddism, this rage at machines? Well, Brookman isn't just any factory. It's a fábrica ocupada, one of almost 200 factories across the country that have been taken over and run by their workers over the past year and a half. For many, the factories, employing more than 10,000 nationwide and producing everything from tractors to ice cream, are seen not just as an economic alternative, but as a political one as well. They are afraid of us because we have shown that if we can manage a factory, we can also manage a country, Celia Martinez, a Brookman worker, said on Monday night. That's why this government decided to repress us. At first glance, Brookman looks like every other garment factory in the world. As in Mexico's hyper-modern maquiladoras and Toronto's crumbling coat factories, Brookman is filled with women hunched over sewing machines, with their eyes straining and fingers flying over fabric and thread. What makes Brookman different are the sounds. There is the familiar roar of machines and the hiss of steam. But there is also Bolivian folk music coming from a small tape deck in the back of the room. And softly spoken voices as older workers lean over younger ones, showing them new stitches. They wouldn't let us do that before, Martinez says. They wouldn't let us get up from our workspaces or listen to music. But why not listen to music? To lift the spirits a bit. Here in Buenos Aires, every week brings news of a new occupation. A 4-star hotel now run by its cleaning staff. A supermarket taken by its clerks. A regional airline about to be turned into a cooperative by the pilots and attendants. In small Trotskyist journals around the world, Argentina's occupied factories, where the workers have seized the means of production, are giddily hailed as the dawn of a socialist utopia. In large business magazines like The Economist, they are ominously described as a threat to the sacred principle of private property. The truth lies somewhere in between. In Brookman, for instance, the means of production weren't seized. They were simply picked up after they had been abandoned by their legal owners. The factory had been in decline for several years. Debts to utility companies were piling up, and over a period of 5 months, the seamstresses had seen their salaries slashed from 100 pesos a week to a mere 2 pesos, not enough for the bus fare. On December 18th, the workers decided it was time to demand a travel allowance. The owners, pleading poverty, told the workers to wait at the factory while they looked for the money. We waited for them until evening. We waited until night, Martinez said. No one came. After getting the keys from the doorman, Martinez and the other workers slept at the factory. They've been running it ever since. They have paid the outstanding bills, attracted new clients, and, without profits and management salaries to worry about, managed to pay themselves steady salaries. All these decisions have been made democratically, by vote in open assemblies. I don't know why the owners had such a hard time, Martinez says. I don't know much about accounting, but for me it's easy. Addition and subtraction. Brookman has come to represent a new kind of labor movement here, one that is not based on the power to stop working, the traditional union tactic, but on the dogged determination to keep working no matter what. It's a demand that's not driven by dogmatism, but by realism. In a country where 58% of the population is living in poverty, workers know they are a paycheck away from having to beg and scavenge to survive. The specter that is haunting Argentina's occupied factories is not communism, but indigence. But isn't it simple theft? After all, these workers didn't buy the machines, the owners did. If they want to sell them or move them to another country, surely that's their right. As the federal judge wrote in Brookman's eviction order, life and physical integrity have no supremacy over economic interests, close quote. Perhaps unintentionally, he has summed up the naked logic of deregulated globalization. Capital must be free to seek out the lowest wages and the most generous incentives, regardless of the toll that process takes on people and communities. The workers in Argentina's occupied factories have a different vision. Their lawyers argue that the owners of these factories have already violated basic market principles by failing to pay their employees and their creditors, even while collecting huge subsidies from the state. Why can't the state now insist that the indebted company's remaining assets continue to serve the public with steady jobs? Dozens of workers' cooperatives have already been awarded legal expropriation. Brookman is still fighting. Come to think of it, the Luddites made a similar argument in 1812. The new textile mills put profits for a few before an entire way of life. Those textile workers tried to fight that destructive logic by smashing the machines. The Brookman workers have a much better plan. They want to protect the machines and smash the logic. And that was Snapshot of a Nation by Naomi Klein from the April 28, 2003 edition of the London Guardian. Naomi Klein's latest book is Fences and Windows. For more on Klein's writing, visit www.nologo.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. For more information on the program, visit our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org. We'll always be filled by